59. The show is coming up next.
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, from New Orleans, Louisiana, on Thanksgiving weekend, where the holiday is not that different from, you know, normal weekday, because it's all about eating. But there is something mildly paradoxical about New Orleans, at least this time of year. I don't know if you notice the datelines on many of the news stories you read in this particular period of time. Health and science stories, they are more often than not Dateline New Orleans, because health and medical conventions are seemingly overwhelmingly held in this city. In every time of the year, you fly into the airport and you see these, to all other mentalities, incomprehensible advertisements in the airport, either for new medications, new spectacular medications that have not yet reached the point where they're advertised on the evening news. Either they haven't been approved, or they're just not getting the advertising push yet, or some technical achievement that, because there are a lot of tech conventions down here as well. But this time of year, the medical conventions become so overwhelming that the billboards spill out of the airport and are all over downtown, I guess, trying to reach those people's eyeballs as they drive, as they're driven to the convention center. And so you see this week particularly, you see these billboards full of people looking clear-eyed and kind of joyously out at you, the viewer, with the name of some medication and that some ad line about them giving themselves another chance. And it just seems remarkable to see all these patented medications being advertised out there in public in the middle of a city that, if it knows how to do nothing else, knows how to self-medicate. Hello, welcome to the show.
Hey! are tears of joy. A child can cry so much until you hear everything they say. But unlike a child, my tears don't help me to get my way. I know love can last through years, but how can love last through tears?
French Quarter of New Orleans, Louisiana, from that other edge of America. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. First, a correction, or an addendum. We're addendumizing, ladies and gentlemen. My pleasure to make that possible. Last week, a story was alluded to on this broadcast. We're addendumizing to an allusion about a law here in the state of Louisiana that requires 15-year-olds to register for the draft before they can get their learner's permit for a driver's license. Turns out, by July 2002, 25 states, 2 territories, and the District of Columbia have already adopted similar laws to Louisiana. According to Selective Service, boys in Oklahoma, Delaware, Arkansas, Utah, Georgia, Hawaii, Alabama, Florida, Colorado, Texas, Louisiana, red state so far, huh? Then Illinois, Ohio, South Dakota, Mississippi, Idaho, Virginia, Wisconsin, New Hampshire, West Virginia, Tennessee, South Carolina, Maryland, Rhode Island, Missouri, the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas, and the Virgin Islands are required to sign up for selective service when they register for driver's licenses. There's no draft coming. It's just a thing we do to intimidate mid-adolescent boys. You know, it's all we can do, really. They've got the culture. Ladies and gentlemen, news from beyond the bubble will be here moments from now. But first, just to lighten things up a little bit, let me read the trades for you. Will you? I can't hear you. From broadcasting and cable, first of all, news from the digital wonderland. Broadcasters push digital television decision delay. I'll read it for you. Opponents of the Federal Communication Commission's so-called free plan for speeding the digital transition have gotten organized and are taking their case to Capitol Hill. The National Association of Broadcasters, ABC, and CBS affiliate groups, minority and rural representatives, and some broadcast unions have formed the Coalition for a Smart Digital TV Transition. Their goal? To keep the FCC from rushing a decision on the digital TV transition. The coalition is united in asking the FCC not to act in December 2004 before the American public can weigh in on its plan, says the group. Broadcasters have pitched an alternative plan that would require cable, bad old cable, to ensure that its subscribers can get a digital picture if broadcasters are delivering a digital signal. And they've also been pushing for guaranteed carriage of not only their analog signal, but any other service, data, news, weather, that they can fit into their digital channel allotment. That, of course, would mean at times when they're not running high-definition television. And you know how often that's going to be. Oop, I stopped reading. Quote, while the FCC looks to potentially force adoption of a complicated and unworkable digital transition plan, most Americans still don't understand what digital television is, let alone that they'll have to buy a new TV to continue watching their local news, the coalition asserts. That is frightening. To have to buy anything to continue watching local news is frightening. Technically, they would only have to buy a converter box, says Broadcasting and Cable, to continue receiving a signal with their old sets, but it would be analog, not digital. The coalition wants there to be a funding mechanism in place to buy set-top boxes for the disadvantaged before any plan is approved. Manny Mirabal, Hispanic Technology and Telecommunications Partnership, says that minority populations will be particularly hard hit, given that they tend to have more TV sets, watch more TV, have less money to pay for new technology, and less access to alternative delivery systems like cable and satellite. We're not into delay for delay's sake, he says. But many issues need to be resolved first. The FCC's current plan, named after Media Bureau Chief Ken Faree, it's not free TV, it's Faree TV, would allow digital signals converted to analog by cable systems to count as digital. Which broadcasters argue deprives viewers of the great pictures and interactivity that are digital television's biggest selling points. That definition of digital would allow analog spectrum to be returned to the FCC by 2009. Without it, says son of colon Mike Powell, the transition could take decades. Who told you that first? Not Mike Powell. And speaking of delays, no, not Tom DeLay, the guy whose name was given to the new rule passed by House Republicans that leaders didn't have to resign their posts when indicted. This is another delay. Viacom to delay live programming also from Broadcasting and Cable. Who's going to read it for you? That's right, me. Viacom Incorporated has agreed to delay live programming across its radio and television properties as part of a $3.5 million indecency settlement. Viacom is settling all outstanding indecency complaints, fines, and proposed fines, with the exception of the $500,000 Janet Jackson Super Bowl fine. And it will put delays on all live programming, TV, radio, network, CBS, and UPN, and local stations. The fines all involved Infinity radio outlets. Viacom has admitted as part of the settlement that some of the broadcasts, specifically on WKRK FM Detroit, were indecent. The FCC proposed a fine against Infinity Station KRK a year ago for a Demonaski and Doyle show broadcast, which involved a series of references to various, and I'm reading this now, various disgusting sexual practices. I guess this means that Broadcasting and Cable magazine was disgusted. Also included was the $357,000 fine for the Sex in St. Patrick's Cathedral stunt on WNEW AM. The settlements involved radio. The consent decree extends into TV as well. A TV and radio delay on live programming will be used on a, quote, reasonable and good faith effort to edit potentially problematic programming. The FCC this week denied indecency complaints against Fox's Keen Eddie for an episode about horse semen, two episodes of the WB's Off Center, and four episodes of NBC's Coupling. That's right. It wasn't indecent enough to survive. And finally, from Advertising Age, Deadline Washington, Congress has slashed the White House Youth Anti-Drug Advertising Program's budget by 17%. Both houses agreed to the new spending bill over the weekend. The ad program seeks to stop youth drug use by targeting children and their parents with youth-oriented ad messages from the Partnership for a Drug-Free America. Officials from the partnership have in the past complained that the rising advertising costs meant more money was needed to do the same job, and that spending cuts would make it more difficult to target youths with sufficient reach and frequency. Capitol Hill says the drug office is spending too much of the advertising money on public relations activities. A year ago, Congress required 78% of the drug office money, to be spent on advertising. This time, Congress added two new restrictions that limited production and non-advertising costs to 10% and required the corporate outreach program to be reinstated. Drug office officials did not return several calls for comment, but mysterious smoke was seen emanating from their offices. No, I just made that up, but the rest of the time I was reading the trades for you, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. This is your brain on less anti-drug money.
When I walk down the street, seems everyone I meet gives me a friendly hello. I guess I'm just a lucky so-and-so. The birds in every tree are all so merrily. They sing wherever I go. I guess I'm just a lucky so-and-so. If you should ask me the amount that's in my bank account, I'd have to confess, y'all, that I'm slipping. But that don't worry me. Confidentially, I've got a dream. It's really pretty. And when the day is through, at night I hurry to a place where love waits, I know. I guess I'm just a lucky so-and-so. if you should ask me the amount that's in my bank account. Baby, I'd have to tell you I'm slipping. But that don't worry me, confidentially. I got a dream, really pimpin'. And when the day is through, at night I hurry to a place where love waits, I know. I guess I'm just a lucky so-and-so. Lucky, just a lucky, lucky so-and-so. So lucky.
Ladies and gentlemen, news from inside and outside the bubble. The Bush administration has decided against reporting South Korea to the UN Security Council for conducting those secret nuclear experiments 4 years ago. The decision made during a phone call between Secretary of State Powell and his successor, Condi Rice. Oh, to be a fly on the phone. Curtailed the proposal by some in the administration who wanted to confront Seoul, the Seoul government, that is. They put confronting Seoul on ice, didn't they? These officials had argued that reporting South Korea to the Security Council would encourage allies to take the same path later with Iran. Seoul, though, had conducted a two-month diplomatic offensive. Not that offensive, I guess. Sending high-level officials to Washington and other capitals to plead its case. It would be using South Korea as a scapegoat, and that is not acceptable, said a South Korean in an interview. He didn't say what kind of goat it would be acceptable. Said a senior U.S. official to the Washington Post, obviously this will impact our goals on Iran, but there is an acknowledgement now by our allies that South Korea's work wasn't government authorized and is on a whole different scale than Iran's. Well, that was the excuse the Pakistanis used, wasn't it? AQ Khan's network, the former head of the Pakistani military, his nuclear proliferation network wasn't authorized by the government, even though he was head of the Defense Department of Pakistan. And yet, reports circulating now indicate that the new Pakistani ambassador to Washington had been among those high in the Pakistani government who knew of and approved AQ Khan's nuclear proliferation efforts. After receiving vows from Seoul, Korea, that no additional experiments will occur, diplomats expect the members of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, to issue a statement noting South Korea's past failings, but welcoming whatever it's doing now. Dateline Abu Ghraib. More aggressive U.S. military operations in Iraq. You've noticed those. One of the results? Guess. More detainees. Have fun, everybody. Doubling the number held by U.S. forces to about 8,300 since early October. The number of detainees has grown by about 4,000 as a result of the activity mainly in Fallujah. Fallujah! I actually got an email from somebody who said it was insensitive to pronounce Fallujah that way. That's what we're all about here at this show, ladies and gentlemen, is sensitivity. The large influx of prisoners is putting stress on U.S. detention operations. That's good news, isn't it? Providing the biggest test yet of new facilities and procedures adopted in the wake of the Abu Ghraib prison scandal earlier this year. So far, according to officials, the flow has been manageable, but many detainees have not yet made it through the system. By the way, the prison building where the Abu Ghraib photographs were taken has been turned over to Iraqi authorities and is used to jail criminals. Remember when George W. Bush said that building was going to be torn down? Forget that. Remember that? Forget that. Detainees in U.S. military custody are kept in recently constructed camps with climate-controlled tents, 3 hot meals a day. For the most cooperative prisoners, there are movies. For the less cooperative prisoners, there are screenings of Alexander the Great. This from the Los Angeles dog trainer. Members of a National Guard battalion preparing for deployment in Iraq said this week they're being treated like prisoners. They're under lockdown rather than soldiers. A number of guard troops also said the training they've been receiving is so poor and the equipment shortages so prevalent that they fear their casualty rate will be needlessly high when they head for Iraq. They say they think their treatment and training reflects bias against guard troops by commanders in the active duty army. "I feel like an inmate with a weapon," says one. Seems redundant to me, but there you go. Dateline Washington from Knight Ridder newspapers, the Army, which has been hard-pressed to find enough soldiers to man the rotations in Iraq and Afghanistan, may soon be faced with an urgent request to find another 5,000 to 7,000 troops. Commanders there have been quietly signaling an immediate need for at least that many more soldiers to add to the Americans already in Iraq. This, they say, is the minimum number needed to allow them to pursue the offensive against the insurgents in the wake of the taking of Fallujah. Far from breaking the back of the insurgency, the capture of Fallujah only served as a signal for the enemy to launch its own offensive in cities across the Sunni Triangle and in Baghdad. The fighters and leaders who fled Fallujah before the Americans launched their attack simply moved to other cities and went straight to work sowing havoc. Those old havoc sowers. The daily number of attacks and incidents in Iraq is now running more than 1,000. The daily number of attacks and incidents in Iraq is now running more than 100 per day, double what it was before the Fallujah offensive began. The Americans are now obliged to rebuild what they destroyed in Fallujah. The city and the reconstruction efforts both have to be secured against the return of the insurgents, thus tying down thousands of American soldiers and Marines when they're needed elsewhere to fight those who escaped from Fallujah. Army planners are looking at a number of temporary stopgap measures to boost the strength in Iraq during January, including the extension of the tours of thousands of soldiers nearing the end of their 12-month combat assignment and speeding up the deployment of the 3rd Mechanized Infantry Division. And yet, from the Boston Globe, a growing number of national security specialists who supported the invasion of Iraq are moving to a new position. Call it run but don't cut. They believe the large U.S. military presence is impeding stability as much as contributing to it, and the United States should begin major reductions in troops beginning early next year. Yes, even the neocons are capable of awakening from their long, fervid dream. It would appear. These assessments, expressed in reports, think tank meetings, and interviews, run counter to the Bush administration's insistence that the troops will remain indefinitely, but some contend that growing support for an earlier pullout could alter the administration's thinking. Those arguing for immediate troop reductions include key Pentagon advisors, prominent neoconservatives, and some of the fiercest supporters of the Iraq invasion. The core of their argument is that even as the U.S.-led coalition goes on the offensive, the United States, by its very presence, is stimulating the resistance. Why, who said that months ago? Those bad old lefties. Quote, "Our large direct presence has fueled the Iraq insurgency as much as it has suppressed it," says Michael Vickers, a conservative-leaning Pentagon consultant and longtime CIA official. Retired Army Major General William Nash, former NATO commander in Bosnia, said, quote, "I resigned from the 'we don't have enough troops in Iraq' club 4 months ago. We have too many now," unquote. Your head spinning yet, ladies and gentlemen? You can't sue me for whiplash. Yonadam Kana, Secretary General of the Assyrian Democratic Movement and a member of Iraq's National Assembly, also backed the U.S.-led removal of Hussein. He now says Washington must prove that the United States is a liberator, not an occupier. Really? I thought we proved that. Didn't we prove that already? Do I have to get more falsetto to take that ironic position? Quote, "I have seen a metamorphosis," says Robert Pfalzgraf, president of the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis in Cambridge, a vocal supporter of Bush's Iraq policy. Quote, "We should not be there with a large force. We should be there with a force that begins to quickly diminish," he said, splitting his infinitive. Few specialists are calling for a complete pullout. They say the United States must first finish training Iraqi forces. Still, a report completed over the summer calling for a complete pullout next year has struck a chord. The conservative-leaning Cato Institute, actually it's libertarian, says, quote, the end of the foreign occupation will seriously undermine the terrorist claims that their act of violence against Iraqis are somehow serving the interests of Iraq. Staying on the current course, looking at the trends, is not going to work, says that report's chief author, Christopher A. Preble. Evidence is growing of anti-American backlash that threatens Iraq's stability, says this report. Says Max Boot, an influential neoconservative thinker. This is turning out to be a lot harder than anyone expected, and harder than it needed to be. I'm not one of those calling for a quick pullout, he added. I agree there is some downside to the U.S. troops' presence. It definitely fuels some nationalist resentment. All things considered, he says, I think we're doing better in Afghanistan, partially because we have fewer troops there. Bush will surprise his opponents by disengaging from Iraq, says Edward Luttwak, a longtime Pentagon consultant, who's argued that the push to create a democracy in Iraq will prove futile. Says Ken Edelman, Mr. Cakewalk, if there is a stable Iraqi government after January, you can withdraw. I would be okay with that. That would be the reverse cakewalk, ladies and gentlemen. And this is Le Show.
My father's voice was a very special thing. And when I went to sleep, I knew I'd wake to hear him sing. And every morning when he warm up, there was hope that it would bring in the joy on his face when he reached that hallowed place. And I had no choice. My father's voice. My father's voice was a very special thing. And in our house of mirrors, there was safety it would bring. And the clouds above my bedroom, they would part and show me spring. And my pride reached its fill, and my sadness lost its will. And I had no choice but to choose my father's voice. Oh, my father's voice still a very special thing. Yet he doesn't seem to understand the pleasure that it brings. Every moment that he sings those Christmas hymns. And proud and I'm pleased that in him must see me. I'm the acorn, he's the oak, heart stronger, heartfelt bloke. Neither one had any choice, so I am my father. Voice.
from CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is At Loggerheads, dichotomous dialogue from both sides of the rhetorical divide. Today, who's at fault in the basketball brawl in Detroit? From the left, Joan Rivers. From the right, Yakov Smirnoff.
Joan, this was most disgraceful display of bad sportsmanship since Comedy Central canceled Live from Branson. Players who make $20 million a year going into stands to attack fans because they threw cups of beer at them? What's the problem? Ron Artest couldn't afford to get his uniform dry cleaned? In Russia, players can't afford to get uniforms. What a country. What kind of example does this set for young people, that violence is a good way to solve problems? That only works if you're government. What a contrast of NBA 20 years ago. Then you had Magic Johnson, Larry Bird. They talk trash. Today the players act like it. In Russia, trash throws you out. What a country. And Joan, on top of disgraceful performance in Olympics, American basketball is getting reputation that only thing players can win is fight with fans. In Russia, tickets buy you. What a country. Seriously, Joan, if I want to see overpaid young men in their underwear acting like hooligans, I'll stay away from the basketball arena and just visit the men's room of my theater in Branson. Joan?
Nice way to sneak in a plug, Yakov, but please, did you see those fans in Detroit? It's a good thing they were so drunk. It distracted you from how ugly they were. My God, the size labels on their T-shirts had more X's than a Bangkok porno bar. Those people had beer bellies so big they had their own FedEx drop. Oh, please. And drunk. These so-called fans were drunker than the groomsmen at Melissa's wedding. This crowd was so lacking in basic class. If you call them trailer trash, the trailer industry could sue you and win. My God, Yakov, imagine having to perform for crowds like this every night. In your case, just imagine performing for crowds. I feel sorry for the players. You're being called every name in the book by people who don't even own the book. And let's not forget the race element here. These were black players being taunted by so-called fans who got lost trying to find their way to the NASCAR race. I'm sorry. If one of these fans threw their beer at me, I'd be racing into the stands faster than Ashley Simpson heading for a lip-sync clinic. From the left, I'm Joan Rivers.
From the right, I'm Yakov Smirnoff, and we're both in the middle on one thing.
It's great to be at loggerheads.
At Loggerheads is produced with the help of the Celebrity Foundation. People you've heard of who care. Next time, another topic of topical interest tackled from the most diametric of angles. At Loggerheads. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
An advertisement for a Vietnam War computer game has been banned in the United Kingdom for referring to napalm. The billboard for Viet Cong Purple Haze from Take-Two Interactive featured the quote, "Napalm never smelled this good," unquote. Seven people complained to the Advertising Standards Authority, which upheld their complaint, saying the quote was likely to cause serious or widespread offense. Napalm killed many Vietnamese civilians. The advertisement for the PlayStation 2 game showed a soldier in combat fatigues in a jungle scene above quotes from magazine reviews of the game. The quote that prompted complaints was taken from official PlayStation 2 magazine. Take-Two Interactive said that quote had been added because the publication concerned was respected in the games industry. You know, respect is so important in the games industry. The company apologized for the offense caused and promised to remove the line from future advertisements. They believed the quote referred to a well-known line from the war film Apocalypse Now. A national Muslim civil liberties organization is protesting comments made on talk show host Don Imus's program, which proves that somebody watches or listens to it. The Council on American Islamic Relations is urging its members to contact MSNBC, which does a television simulcast of the radio program. That's good watching. To express their discontent. According to the group, on Friday, November 19th, an on-air personality pretended to be a, quote, senior military affairs advisor on the Imus in the Morning program. He referred to a wounded Iraqi who was shot and killed by a U.S. Marine in a mosque as a, quote, booby-trapped raghead cadaver, unquote. On November 12th, I was engaged in an on-air discussion with a colleague during footage of Yasser Arafat's funeral. Quote, they're stupid to begin with, but they're brainwashed now, unquote, his colleague said, referring to Palestinians. Quote, stinking animals. They ought to drop the bomb right there, kill them all right now, unquote. On Tuesday, MSNBC spokeswoman Leslie Zeller Schwartz issued a statement pointing out that the views expressed on the IMS program are not those of MSNBC. Having said that, it was unfortunate that these remarks were telecast on MS, she said. We sincerely apologize to anyone who is offended by these remarks. Unquote. A local business in Kansas City, Missouri, that sent out solicitations made up to look like invoices seeking thousands of dollars in fees has apologized. An attorney for Waste Check Consulting Programs of Mission, Missouri, said that the Waste Consulting Company had notified the hospitals, nursing homes, and churches that received the original letters that they should ignore the invoice lookalikes. It was a solicitation, and my client is not collecting any funds, and they apologize for any confusion, said attorney Mark Arensberg. When you have your attorney doing your apologizing for you, it's double hip. Deadline Madison, Wisconsin, a radio host apologized this week for calling Condoleezza Rice Aunt Jemima, but refused to back down from the criticism that she is a black trophy of the Bush administration. John Sly Sylvester, the program director and morning personality on WTDY-AM, wrote a letter of apology to local newspapers. Quote, I'm concerned that I've offended many African Americans by using a crass term to describe an incompetent, dishonest political appointee of the Bush administration. I apologize, wrote Sylvester, who is white. Really? Sir Elton John stunned British radio audiences the other morning when he let some expletives fly during BBC Radio 1's breakfast show, at first pretending he wasn't sure he was on the air when he used one particularly raw word. Sir Elton went on to reel off a string of oaths after he had been cautioned that he was indeed on the air. Asking if each was permissible, he added, quote, I'm sorry, I have this weird syndrome approaching 10 a.m. Hapless host Chris Moyles apologized and muttered, thanks, everyone. You're listening to my last show on Radio 1. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. The news from the entertainment industry is in. United Kingdom, that is to say British record companies, have seen record album sales. That's not record album sales. That's record album sales in the past year. The best ever year. 237 million CDs sold in the 12 months preceding September, according to the British Phonographic Industry, BPI. There's been a 3% rise compared with last year. Sales of singles are also up. 11 of the top 20 albums of the year were signed to UK record labels. So, sounds weird, doesn't it? Coming in the wake of complaints by United States record companies that downloading is killing the industry. According to BPI Chairman Peter Jameson, the British record industry's continued investment in new British talent was paying off, he said. Oh, I see. Investing in talent, eh? That's their secret. And Dateline New York, Dan Rather, said Tuesday he will step down as CBS Evening News anchor this March, after nearly a quarter century in the job. He'll become a correspondent for both editions of 60 Minutes, including the Wednesday edition, where his report on George W. Bush's National Guard service triggered an ongoing investigation by two outside authorities into CBS News' use of documents supplied by Bill Burkett, a longtime Bush opponent, documents which CBS could not succeed in authenticating. John Roberts and Scott Pelley are frequently mentioned as candidates to succeed, Rather. CBS News, a distant third in the ratings, will also look elsewhere, according to the Associated Press. Rather replaced Walter Cronkite in 1981 when Cronkite was forced to retire at the age of 65. Rather is 73. Rather told the Associated Press that the National Guard story had nothing to do with the announcement of his retirement. Everybody will have their own thoughts about this, he said, but this was a separate decision apart from that. That's a quote from his interview. Discussions with CBS management about when he would leave began in 1999, were shelved after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and then renewed last summer, he said. Rather said he and CBS chairman Leslie Moonves agreed his departure would be sometime early next year, and Rather settled on March 9th, the 24th anniversary of when he succeeded Walter Cronkite. Tom Brokaw, of course, is retiring as of this coming week. Brokaw said he was pleased for Dan that he's come to a conclusion about his own life, as I have in my case. Dan and I have known each other competitively and personally for a long, long time, Brokaw said, repeating two words with L's in them. Occasionally, on the competitive side, it would be tiny bumps in the road, but when you think of all that we've been through, we have a pretty strong relationship, so I wish him well, unquote. What kind of day is it at Black Rock? Bad.
Good evening, Mr. Rudder.
Evening, Gerald.
You are on tonight, sir?
Beg pardon?
You dining alone tonight, sir?
He's asking if you're dining alone, Daniel.
Thomas. Yes, Gerald, I am. And maybe don't buy a billboard in Times Square next time you want to announce it to the world. Hmm? How are you, Brother Brokaw?
Well, I'm just on my way to the men's room, but, you know, we've got a big party in the back room.
Oh.
Kind of a celebration of my leaving Nightly News.
Celebration of leaving, huh?
You don't have to repeat it. I said it plainly.
No, I'm just considering how that sounds. Doesn't sound like the country I've just been riding through. Come on, set a spell, Thomas.
Well, okay. I just want to get back before Tim Russert's toast.
Brother Russert?
Yes, sir. NBC Washington Bureau Chief and host of Meet the Press.
You really are required to say that.
Mm-hmm. Even in private conversation. He got the idea from Michael Jackson's King of Pop contract.
Well, sir, it all sounds as benign as a polecat's pimple. Human frailty never has been a capital offense, or so I thought. I guess caring too much is a little bit out of fashion. Like $10 blue jeans.
Mm-hmm. Listen, by the way, thank you for making the announcement this week. It only distracted from the promos for my Dateline special, not for my actual departure.
2-hour special, wasn't it? Eyewitness to history?
Yeah.
Wonder if I'll get a 2-hour special. Or a 1-hour special. Most likely a farewell crawl under the Final Four. You know, March Madness.
Listen, Daniel, you were planning to go anyway.
Please, sir. Reality check. I was planning to die in the anchor chair. I mean, that's the whole problem with being at the top of the mountain. Every place else is down.
Oh, Daniel, I've got plenty on my plate.
You got what, sir?
Plenty on my plate. My plate.
You're ready to order. You have plenty on your plate.
No, that's okay. I'm at the big happy table over there.
Uh-huh. Gerald, I'll just have a whiskey sour, double sour.
Yes, sir.
I mean, I've got a new book project.
Oh?
Mm-hmm. Business Management Secrets of the Greatest Generation. And right behind that, for next November, Christmas with the Greatest Generation.
Recipes from vets?
Warm-hearted recollections.
Sorry?
Recollections of Christmases on the front lines of World War II.
All right, sir. Point granted, it is possible to do serious journalism after leaving the big desk. But Thomas, as I pointed out to our fearless leader, CBS News doesn't guide anything by forcing me out. While our bench is as weak as a heifer's yodel.
Well, look, Thomas, Brian Williams is good. I mean, he's damn good, but let's be realistic. He's no me. He's no you.
Hmm.
You know, maybe one day he'll grow into the likable gravitas, but...
And meanwhile, Brother Jennings rolls on as if he got a lifetime pass along with his citizenship.
Yeah. Well, he didn't go gray on camera. We could have done that.
I did. I inhaled more diaphragms than a chop-chop Chevy. But at some point, a wee small voice said to me, Daniel, pardon me, sir, but you can't be selling the truth when your hair is fibbing. Also, to put the whole deck on the table, the brown hair wasn't helping the ratings, so...
At least you went out with your dignity intact, not under the cloud of some kangaroo blue-ribbon committee.
Thomas, please, don't feed horse poop to the pony.
Well,
the right-wing conservatives, the bloggers, they put a notch in their gun with my name on it, a notch that's Pedernales wide and Grand Canyon deep. This was our fearless leader canceling the TV movie about the Reagans all over again, only this time, I was the movie.
Look, whatever comes out about the Bush story and the documents and their legitimacy or lack thereof...
Excuse me?
Lack.
As in Andy Lack?
Exactly. Whatever comes out, you're well out of there, Daniel. It's not good for anybody to be walking around with a bullseye on their back. Who knows? I mean, the next time, Kenneth might have wanted more than the frequency.
It wasn't Kenneth who said it. He thought I was Kenneth.
Whatever.
Thomas, please. They came after Ed Murrow with more guns blazing than at a Mexican wedding. CBS News didn't ask him to retire.
No. They moved him to a show where he interviewed celebrities. Look, well, Daniel, I know I'm a little younger than you. I don't remember those days as well as you do. I mean, I was covering freeway collisions on the Channel 4 News at 11 with Kelly Lang in Los Angeles when you were already in the Washington Bureau, but...
Well, sir, so you were eyewitness to Southern California traffic history. No matter. The point is, we didn't follow the Murrow standard this year. We were acting like the prairie dog in the fast lane just hoping to get the license number of the 18-wheeler bearing down on us.
Prairie dogs read license plates? Look, Daniel, between now and the end of March, this will all blow over. The committee report will be gathering dust on Andy Hayward's bookcase. The critics will be writing about whether John Roberts is too gray to compete with Brian Williams. The bloggers will have their teeth into Arlen Specter's pant leg. Your colleagues will have the chance to give you the kind of party I'm missing right now. And
I don't want to put too fine a point on it, Brother Brokaw. You know, there's still... hundreds of fine people at CBS News doing the best they know how. Mm-hmm. They'll still let me do a 60 Minutes piece every once in a while when some foreign dictator wants to sit down with somebody from 60 who doesn't have to take his earring out before the tape rolls. But when I walk out onto West 57th Street for the last time come this March, a big part of the soul of this organization will be hopping into the back seat of the limo with me. You can bank that bucket, bark at it, and bite it.
We're new whiskers, how are I? You like a slimp tonight?
Just a second, Gerald.
I come back.
Maybe you did it the right way, Thomas. Maybe I was too hard driving, too much safari jacket and scuffed up shoe leather, too little health and lifestyle. Maybe I was stuck playing five-card stud in a time of seven-card anaconda with picture cards wild.
Daniel, I better get back. Matt Lauer's paging my cell phone.
I just want to thank you for your kind public words, Brother Brokaw. This week. And listen, give me a call after the holidays. I've got a little project we might be able to collaborate on.
Oh?
Yes, sir. 100 favorite country songs of the greatest generation.
Not bad. Happy holidays, Daniel.
Happy what, sir?
Holidays.
Got it. You too, Brother Brokaw.
Ladies and gentlemen, I so infrequently remember to mention this. I'm busting my buttons that I remember today. There is an occasional low-impact email newsletter sent to listeners of this broadcast who request it, only who request it. List isn't lent, sold, allowed to be peeked at by anybody else. If you want to get on that list... just send a request to LeBlast, LEBLAST, dash subscribe at luxmedia.com. Lux is LUX. How else would you do it? That concludes this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan. Think of it. Around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network. Think of that. Up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.5, whatever it is. I'm doing this from memory, can you tell? Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it on your computer. Your computer. That one right there. At www.harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, and now available as a free download at www.audible.com/LeShow. And it would be just like either sending more troops to Iraq or bringing them home if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. LeShow Internet Services by Steve Mack. LeShow playlists always available at harryshearer.com. A tip of the LeShow chapeau to the Pittsburgh and San Diego desks and to Jeffrey at Audio Works here in New Orleans for making today's broadcast available around the world, bringing Shearer to the nations. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.
You've been listening to LeShow on 89.9 KCRW. Stay tuned for This American Life, coming up next.
The Hotel Daniele is redolent with the splendor and romance of Venice. Make it your own private Venice. Win 5 nights for 2 at the Daniele, the luxury collection, flights courtesy World Travel BTI. Enter 3 sweepstakes, trips to Venice and Greece, plus a chance to win a mini convertible. Subscribe or renew. Go to kcrw.com, by mail, or call 888-600-KCRW. Act by December 31st. Rules 5 a.m., 11 p.m.
This is KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9, KCRI Indio Palm Springs at 89.3, KCRY Mojave Antelope Valley at 88.1, and KCRU Oxnard Ventura at 89.1. KCRW subscriber-supported radio, handpicked music, and NPR News morning, noon, and night, webcasting all news, all music, and KCRW at kcrw.com and radio at iTunes. KCRW, a community service of Santa Monica.